which resulted in enormous numbers of deaths, including what has been called a genocide in the early 1980s. So in some ways, Israel has long been a junior partner to the United States when it comes to military and foreign policy. Places and moments where the United States might not want to be involved very explicitly, Israel has stepped in to supply the weapons and the advisors and the technology and the strategies that the United States might not have wanted to do for themselves.
Viet-Tan Nguyen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning author, professor at the University of Southern California, his latest book, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other. Also co-editor of the new book, The Cleaving, Vietnamese Writers in the Diaspora. We'll link to your op-ed in the Los Angeles Times today. Americans are still learning the wrong lessons from Vietnam. Viet-Tan Nguyen is on a national book tour. He'll be here in New York, in Brooklyn, Thursday night at the Center for Fiction, and at Rizzoli Bookstore in Manhattan on Friday. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has job openings. Go to democracynow.org to learn more. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Come on, the peace train. This peace train only rolling.
Everyone jump on the peace train.
Come on, come on, come on. Yeah, come on.
95.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, 88.7 WRHU, Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, and 88.3 WRCT, Pittsburgh, Radio Carnegie Tech. You're listening to the One World Radio Show. I'm your host, Cody Moore. Joining with me is Ricky in New York and Lydia in Cape Town.
Hello, Cody.
Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon, Lydia.
Good morning to everyone, and good off. Yeah.
We are finally having the seasons shift a bit, right?
I mean,
it went from like 30 or 28 degrees for me to 40 the other day, and I gotta say, I did not like it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just too, I don't know. For me, like, anytime it gets above, like, 70, 75 degrees, it just, at least where I am, it's so humid that I prefer a dry heat. So that's just my personal take.
Oh, really? Lydia doesn't know anything about the heat where she lives.
Not at this moment. Not at this point. We are heading into winter, so on my side,
no.
It's really cold.
Well, we're very honored and privileged that we have a gentleman all the way who... the weather in Germany might be where he's coming from might be a little bit different than it is by us. We have Professor Klaus Bernke, who is coming us from Germany to discuss the topic of cross-cultural psychology. Thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
So I was discussing this topic last night before we did the taping with my father, and he said, what is cross-cultural psychology? So for those who don't know, what is cross-cultural psychology?
Well, this is, of course, always disputed. It started actually with the feeling in the academic sphere of psychology. Psychology is the science of American college students and white rats. Some famous psychologists said that about, I presume, something like 100 years ago. And that time, it was actually the textbooks worldwide were filled with lab experiments among male American college students and little white rats who were running through mazes and things like that. And in the... Well, typically in the late 1960s, the question emerged that, well, maybe what we know about psychological phenomena is different if we have participants in our study from other cultures than what is now 50 years later called the weird countries. Weird countries means Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic country. So that nicely is then spelled weird. But this started in the late 1960s, in the early 1970s. And then psychology kind of spread out into other parts of the world. And typically the studies that had been conducted in the US were then, say, replicated, or people tried to replicate them in other parts of the world. And other parts of the world then typically in the beginning meant East Asia and, for example, the Academic Association of Cross-Cultural Psychology was founded in 1972 in Hong Kong, which was a British colony, crown colony at that time, but of course, strong East Asian influence at the International Association for Cross-Cultural Psychology. And people just wanted to know which parts of psychological knowledge depend on something that is universal, that you will find everywhere in the world, wherever you do the study, and which other parts of psychological knowledge are only understandable in the immediate cultural context where the people who you do the study with come from. But then there are also disputes of why cross-cultural psychology. Cross-cultural psychology at the same time means you have a comparative approach. So you would always want to compare culture X, culture Y, and culture Z with regard to a phenomenon that you're interested in. Yeah, we can come to that a little later, but cross-cultural psychology means, yeah, you compare across cultures. The competing strand of culture of research is cultural psychology. Cultural psychology stays within one culture, which was would then typically not be from the weird world, but would be from say more interesting parts of the globe, and you would try to understand phenomena bottom up from what's happening in a certain culture, and so that's cultural psychology. But my personal understanding and my personal also to some degree opinion is that the comparative stuff is more important, because then you really see where the differences are.
And what got you first interested in this topic as something to pursue in your career, in your research? What was it about it for you?
That's an interesting question. Well, certainly I was always interested in, well, traveling to interesting places. There are some large psychology conferences after the Second World War. This really became a tradition that all 4 years or so, there are global gatherings of psychologists somewhere in the world. In 1988, this took place in Sydney in Australia. And I, as a relatively young person, how old was I then? 37. I had managed to get some grant to fly to Australia and present some study there that I had done as an early postdoc. Then came people to the same conference who said, "Well, we've just been at a wonderful conference in Newcastle, also that's not far away from Sydney." And these people, I found that their narratives, research interests, I found it so interesting. And I found out that they were members of this International Association of Cross-Cultural Psychology. And so in Australia, having traveled to Australia, befriended myself with these colleagues, became a representative for Europe there. Later, I became Secretary General of the organization. From 2016 to 2022, I was their president. But it's more or less by chance that it went exactly this way.
Now, I was reading before about your work the night before we were doing this, and I noticed there are some topics that are... We're going to get into all the major research topics that you're interested in. Was value change and value transmission, social cohesion, and political socialization. Before we get into any of that, can you just break down what all three of those topics mean?
Actually, the value topic originally was one of my core topics. Values are something that you can assess or measure rather easily if you throw questionnaires at people's heads, so to speak, and they're supposed to indicate how important is freedom for them, how important is equality to them, how important is fun to them, how important is security to them, etc., etc. And I got to know one of the world famous value researchers at another one of these cross-cultural conferences in Nara in Japan. His name is Shalom Schwartz. He's an Israeli or an American Israeli. He said, "Well, I don't have any data from East Germany. Can you bring me data from East Germany?" I said, "Yeah, sure. I can try," and I succeeded. And so I worked for about 10 years on the topic of values. And values, of course, is something that individuals hold. All of us hold certain values. How are you brought into holding certain values? Well, parents will play an important role. Not always in the sense of that you have hold the same values as your parents, but you also... Some that you value, your parents cherish, you don't like so much. Others you have more or less the same, you prefer more or less the same values. And so I got into value transmission. Value transmission is I studied simultaneously, or I distributed questionnaires to the daughter, the son, the mother, and the father. And I studied how similar or dissimilar are the values. That's value transmission. social cohesion is something that is almost a bit away from psychology. It's almost a sociological topic. Also, I'm talking a lot about not accidents, but coming to a topic by chance. In the early 2010s, I received a phone call from Bertelsmann Company. Bertelsmann is the largest media company in the world. They own, for example, Random House. They own Penguin. They own, surprisingly for Americans, they're the largest media company in the world. And they also fund research. And they said, well, you have done work on values, and we would like to know how important are common values, that is, that people who live in a certain geopolitical entity, to use a fancy word, in a certain country, in a certain city, in a certain region, how similar are their values? Because at that time, it was hypothesized that the more similar the value orientations of the population in a certain area are, the more cohesive this entity is. And for example, what we did indeed find that we did a study of 34 countries from the OECD world. In Scandinavia, social cohesion is always very high. We can show that from 1989 to 2020, there's always one of the Scandinavian countries on one of the ranks, 1, 2, 3. So Norway before Sweden, before Denmark, or something like that. And so this means their people have similar values, but they are also tolerant vis-a-vis people holding different values. Germany is in the upper, rank 10, rank 11, the U.S. has now gone down to also the 10, 12 ranks. This is social cohesion. And political socialization is actually, if you look at values again, but now you don't describe how similar the values of children or of parents and their offspring are, but you look at how does it work that in some families, parents and the children have very similar values, whereas in other families, they have developed totally different values. So the children have opposing values to what the parents have. And the process of how people generate or how they grow into certain value orientations, that's the core topic of political socialization.
I'm curious, you recently published a study that looked at the effect of microaggressions in African migrants in Germany. And so I'm curious, from what I had read, it looked like you were looking at the externalized interventions of support on microaggressions. I'm curious if you would be willing to talk a little bit more about that.
It's a bit difficult for me to do that because the main author is a Nigerian German who is kind of the champion of this type of research. This is the guy's name is Adekunle Adedeji. He comes from Nigeria but has been living in Germany for, I think, 10 years, also has family here. Microaggressions, I can say a few words of what it is. If you say you walk into a shop and there are people of diverse ethnic backgrounds, well, what you would typically nowadays say where there are people of color around. And if you then, instead of using the neutral term people of color, use one of the more derogatory terms for non-whites, then this is not usually at first instance received as a hefty aggression, but it's more or less a, well, some researchers call it a microaggression, because some people don't even realize that they're aggressive. Yeah, if they comment, for example, on skin color in a, let's say, non-politically correct way or something, that is the topic of this colleague of mine. I cannot really say much more than this, because often there, psychology is also nowadays has adopted a tradition from the natural sciences where if some article is published, you typically have a lead author, then somebody who you have discussed the stuff with, somebody who knows his or her way very well for statistics or something, and they lump their talents together. And with the microaggressions, I should not claim that I'm, in substantive terms, the expert. I've more or less advised this study and immunized it against statistical criticism, because I'm a statistics textbook author and things. So I shouldn't claim that I really know very much on the microaggression substance of the topic.
Something else I think worth mentioning is, because you have all these publications and research topics, what got you into, as we mentioned before, the value transmission, the social cohesion, the political socialization, even what Cody mentioned, your various publications? What gets you interested in those specific topics? Because cross-cultural psychology, as we were discussing before we got on the air, all of us in like our little text thing, it's a very broad topic. So what got you interested in the little micro topics that you study and do research on and publish?
First of all, of course, I think my family upbringing was very important in the choice of the general topic of fairness, of tolerance, of openness towards other people's opinions, etc. This was very, very important in my family of upbringing. So this kind of generated the focus of what I typically do. Then I would say what plays a role is in my, and this is not probably all colleagues would subscribe to that, but in my academic, let's call it career or trajectory or whatever you want, meeting interesting other people was, I think, the motor. I've prepared quite a number of peace psychology papers. There, I must say, one of the triggers, beyond my own family experience, one of the triggers was I met in 1989 the famous Morton Deutsch from New York at an international meeting, and he was such a convincing elder colleague that I just said, oh, well, wow, what a figure. And so I was kind of drawn into this, by not that I couldn't steer my wishes, but I was drawn into it by interesting, or potent, academically potent other figures who had produced great stuff. And I said to myself, obviously, this is in hindsight, maybe not even did I say that in the moment, but I said, let me also do something of on a similar topic.
And now, Klaus, your research touches on some big themes. You spoke a bit more of them right now, like values, culture. And you know, through that, how people learn to see the world of culture and values. Like, what's one thing that you've learned about people and their culture that really changed your own view of the world?
I believe, although this may be to some degree a tautology, but I think seeing the world brings you to a point where you see the world differently. Because I have traveled, and not as a tourist, but I've traveled many, many countries, including South Africa, including just recently being commissioned by the South African government to do a study on social cohesion in South Africa. And this, of course, then, well, you can't just sit on in your German nice ivory tower and not really try to understand the world in another place where you then even commissioned to do a study because people know that you're quite good in doing this and that type of study. But you have to delve into their cultural life too, and not just sit in the office and I always say twist numbers because I work with quantitative data. I always liked to be into close contact and also into cooperation with people from a quite different background. This has become simpler in recent years, and also, let's face it, this work is not done for free. So why do I say that? Because somebody, all these travels or these distributing questionnaires into, well, difficult areas in South Africa is something that you need money for. And because somebody has to sponsor that. And I must admit that often that was also a push in the sense of, will I be able to raise money for this interesting study? For example, in South Africa, we closely cooperated with Daryl Swanepoel, who was the last chair of the Apartheid Party, who brought the Apartheid Party into the African National Council in 2001. And he then said, okay, I have good connections to Telecom South Africa, and they're interested in study on social cohesion because seemingly the ethnic groups of South Africa are drifting apart after the Rainbow Nation didn't really work out as well as it could have been, et cetera, et cetera. So this sounds self-critical and is also even meant that way. Our job also is to chase after money who is going to fund certain studies. And this also, I didn't want to say that corrupts you, but it always your attention is drawn into, yeah, get into contact with people, get into contact with the authorities in another country, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not always your free choice. What do I want to do? I can choose which book I want to read, but my research is not book research. I do research with real data, with surveys, with interviews, with focus groups of people. So much of this is also governed by, will it allow us to gain the interest of a funder while staying true to yourself and your own philanthropic interests?
And that's interesting to hear, you know. And I was looking at your work as well. You've also published work about peace psychology.
Yes.
So what does peace mean to you in the context of your studies?
Yeah, the questions the group asks is really, yeah, I don't think about them every day, but they are very, very necessary and worthwhile to think about, because peace can mean something very different. It can mean keep calm at every expense and etc. But it also has to do with my own biography. Years when I became politically active were the 1970s and 80s. Mostly the 1980s. And in the 1980s, you may recall, at least from history books, that in Europe, this was the time when Cold War was really close to being a hot war. There were new missiles deployed in West Germany, in the then East Germany, in the German Democratic Republic. We went on demonstrations with a million participants in the old German capital of Bonn, and then again happened the thing. I was a citizen, I was an activist, but then I said, well, where is the academic research on this topic? And it turned out that there was no academic research in Germany on this topic. And so some people from a medical doctors organization came to me and said, shouldn't we start something like that in Germany? Nobel Prize in 1985, way back, 1985 was given to an international physicians organization, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. So they came to me and said, yeah, you can do questionnaire studies. We should do a questionnaire study in Germany. And I did start it with their advice. Yeah, and this study is still is running. It's we started with about 1,500 14-year-olds in 1985, and I'm still every 3.5 years I'm reapproaching them, and we have 200 that we have now just finished the 12th time that we surveyed them. So we know how the original, the people from the outside call them peaceniks, how they developed through their lives. Now, they were 14 in the beginning, and now they're 50, 52 or 53. And this is rare that anybody in the world, I don't know of anybody, has these kinds of data. But it was more or less, and I've repeated that the umpteenth time now, I was more or less drawn into something I felt worthwhile from my own upbringing, from what the people around me felt of interest. I turned it into a part of my academic work, but to some degree, this was by accident. Not that it turned me a different person, but that I did exactly that was more or less an accident.
And you've also had a spoken interest in political attitudes, as in like xenophobia. Like, it's big and often sensitive topics. So what sparked your interest in studying those areas?
Yeah, I almost start to laugh. The topic was something that was in talking to my parents, in talking to my study colleagues, et cetera, et cetera. And then in the early 2000s, I got an email from a person who said, yeah, I am a Nigerian, but I will soon go to South Africa. I want to do a study of Zimbabwean refugees to South Africa who live more or less under the bridges in the border areas to Zimbabwe. And can we do a study? And I said, yeah, that's very interesting. That's I haven't done exactly that study, but so we started it. We wrote a book on that. So now this colleague is now a research professor, more or less a highly established research professor in Mafikeng. These are, in a way, these are, sometimes something happens and something evolves out of what just happened. And I just always had an open, let me say, an open mind or an open heart or curiosity for something that was in line with my own political convictions, but rather uncovered in academia. So nobody had done a questionnaire study with homeless Zimbabweans in South Africa. We did this and published a book on that.
Something that you just said that I found very interesting was you said to have the open mind and the open heart. I'm noticing, at least here in the United States, and you could see if that's more of a phenomenon around the world with your research, that a lot of people don't seem to have that open mind and open heart when it comes to differing views on topics like political socialization and what our values are and how people should assimilate with society. What have you seen in your research through the years that shows that people, you could either inspire us and say that people, maybe the perception is that false, that people don't really have that open mind and open heart around the world. What are you seeing with that?
Yeah, this is also something, of course, I would not pretend to really have an answer. But what is indeed, what one can indeed find also in these multi-country studies, of some of them I have been part of, is that the where people are, yeah, let me say, more tolerant vis-a-vis people with other opinions, people are at the same time typically happier or more satisfied with their lives. So that's two different aspects of positivity in the sense. So you either when you think about your life and you're satisfied with it, you mark questionnaires in a specific way. But you can also ask for how happy are you, and the same result comes out actually. So if there is a tolerant political climate, it has become quite obvious that wherever there's a tolerant political climate, people in general, in the whole community, are, yeah, shall I say, happier, because happy is a bit difficult in the US context, because you have this famous sentence in your constitution and the pursuit of happiness, which is actually often and understood as the pursuit of wealth and not so much of your psychological health and well-being. I think it is something, if there is a basic current of tolerance, you can say that the better off people report to be, better off in a psychological sense, not in a monetary sense or anything like that.
Something else that I wanted to touch on was that in prep for this, I saw, because Lydia asked you about peace psychology, back in 2024, last year, you had received the Ralph K. White Lifetime Achievement Award from Division 48 Peace Psychology of the American Psychological Association in recognition of your decades-long activities in the field of peace and conflict research. And I mentioned your study of the peace movement surveyed in 1985. How would you say that people's attitudes around the world towards peace, war, conflict, all these variety of topics have changed throughout the last four decades? And where would you say the attitudes are today?
You hear me sighing, because this question is so big that there really is a good chance that that the answer will certainly be incomplete, because there are indeed quite many signs that we're in a particularly difficult time. Of course, this may be the view from Europe. We had the Russian attack on Ukraine. We had Hamas capturing Israeli citizens, and then Israel retaliating with, well, heavy bombing of the entire Gaza Strip. And this makes it very difficult to say what the view of peace is around the world. Peace, I think, all the time is something that had changing views. Peace, from the viewpoint of its antagonists, peace is something for cowards. This, of course, is a terrible narrowing of the question. And of course, peace is also. Sometimes scolded as, well, peace is not only good because it asks for harmony, and harmony means that those who are on the top of the social ladder stay on top, and those who are at the bottom of the social ladder stay at the bottom, and they all get along nicely. This is certainly also not peace. So I really have a hard time to seriously respond to what you ask. There are, of course, understandings that say peace is something that has to be negotiated every day from scratch everywhere in the world. That's also I wouldn't say a gimmick, but it is something like, well, what is the in-depth meaning if you say that? I don't know if I can give you a good answer to your question if I'm very serious about it.
That's fine. I just noticed something very interesting, because now you work in education roles because you're a professor at Constructor University. And I just noticed, I thought it was very interesting that you had worked at a university in Moscow, and shortly after the invasion, you had resigned from the position. Is that correct?
Yeah, that also has to do with my individual biography. My father was a soldier in Hitler's army and lieutenant, so not a leader, and he had fought in Russia. He was always in favor of one should spend a lot of time to get along with each other. Yeah, but my father died in 2000, but he was, very important for me. And then in 2014, maybe 2013, but okay, I got an email from Moscow, from colleagues from Moscow I had met in earlier times at international conferences. They said, well, we have a vacancy here at the Higher School of Economics for a guest professor. You can do it on the side of your job in Bremen. You don't have to be in Moscow more than 25 days a year. The other you can do as remote work, and all work was done in English, but I also speak some Russian. So I said, what a wonderful opportunity. And then I had a contract that started in 2017 in April to teach and research in Moscow, mostly do research together with them, and very nice colleagues, very open-minded. Yeah, and then came this military aggression of Russia against Ukraine, and as somebody who is really in the let's call it the peace camp, I said I cannot cooperate with this institution anymore, because even the institution Higher School of Economics were supportive of President Putin's decisions. I stopped the cooperation with the institution, but my compromise was I continued the cooperation on individual papers with individual colleagues from there. So it's not that I have any formal relationship to the Higher School of Economics in Moscow anymore. But of course, there are papers, also newer papers from last year or whatever, where I am on the same paper with colleagues from the so-called HSE, the Higher School of Economics, and me on there, and maybe somebody from whatever, also somebody from the US. It was not an easy decision, but I thought, well, people, individual colleagues who haven't said explicitly, I support Putin's military aggression, why should I not cooperate with them anymore? And so I have been doing that, and I will continue to do that, although I don't find institutional cooperation admissible anymore.
That's very fascinating, that topic, that you took that stand, were brave enough to do so. Because you see, here in the States, people are afraid to speak up because of what the potential consequences or the outcome may be.
Yeah.
So I think that's very courageous that you did that. What would you say is something that you learned about all these topics through your research and through your findings through the years that really stuck out to you that you never really would have seen coming, looking at it from an outsider's perspective like mine or Lydia's?
What did I learn from this? I think the main... let me call it self-reward, was that in psychology, psychology is such a broad academic discipline. You can certainly concentrate on topics that are totally apolitical. In the sense of, yes, you can work on geometric optical illusions, or you can work on traffic psychology, and you can work for companies that develop autonomous driving. There are many psychologists in that sphere at the moment. For me, I was always sure that I wanted to see my academic activity as political activism. And this is, of course, a difficult stance, because if you have a clear political position, this, of course, it's counterintuitive to the approach of academic research, that you have to be neutral in a certain sense what's the outcome of your research. Because if people catch you that you say manipulate or kind of push results into the direction of your cherished hypotheses or so, you have no chance. So people have to really acknowledge the quality of your work, in the sense of, yes, there is somebody who treats the data as it should be on a very high international quality level, but this person at the same time does have a clear-cut political stance for which he or she works, has been working for decades. I think that is the thing that I see as a self-rewarding process, because I don't want to be a bad scientist in the sense of pushing results into the direction that I cherish, but at the same time I don't want to be a scientist who just engages in topics that are for example, in sports psychology, which I find an interesting field, but I would never have put my career into that. That's not my field.
If there's one final thing that you'd want listeners from this to take away from, when it comes to, like you had said before, the thing that just stuck with me was the open mind, the open heart, be more understanding to hear it from someone with a different background, have more of an appreciation for where someone's coming from in the world of our cross-culturals, how we all interact with each other. What would your piece of advice be?
I think I formulated this spontaneously, and I think the open mind and the open heart for the research process. This is the important thing, and of course you can do that in a very academic way, because some of my work, for example, works with how important is it for the findings of psychology as an academic discipline that most instruments that are used for questionnaires, scales, etc., come from the US, and 95% come from the real world, and only about 3 to 5% come from countries that have nothing to do with the weird world. I think this open mind and open heart is a general approach to academic production. I think it should be implanted into every beginner of the academic trajectory. And I don't know if all that many people learn that in their university studies, but I keep my fingers crossed that they do.
Well, we thank you very much for taking time to talk to us about the topic today on the show. Klaus Boehnke. Yep. We really do appreciate. Say your name for the listeners one more time.
I'm Klaus Boehnke from Bremen.
Well, thanks so much for coming on our show today. We really do appreciate it. You've been listening to the One World Community Radio Show on 89.5 FM, Cape Town Bush Radio. You have also been listening to it on WRCT 88.3, Pittsburgh Radio Carnegie Tech, and WRGU 88.7 FM, Hempstead, New York, Radio Hofstra University. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us do not understand what we are facing or how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health.
If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Oh, Disasters, my baby has been around for me. Kingdom be falling, angels be calling. None of that could ever make me leave. Yeah. Every time I look into your eyes, I see it. You're all I need. Every time I get a bit excited, I feel it. Ooh.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
If there's one place you can count on being open 24 hours, it's 911.
Austin 911, do you need police, fire, EMS, or mental health services?
A small team of people answers the phones for that last option, mental health, trying to help people on what might be their worst day.
I can hear that you're going through some very real and difficult things and that you're very unsafe right now.
We spend a whole day with them in the latest episode of 24 Hours in Austin. Find it at KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
The late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would have been 96 this year had he lived out a dream for racial equality in this country. He was a man who walked among the oppressed and poor, a man who questioned unfair laws and went to jail rather than submit to them. King was a passionate fighter for civil rights, and although he died by violence, his life and teachings were dedicated to a deep disrespect for violence and its consequences. He won a Nobel Prize for Peace. His lectures and dialogues stirred the conscience of a nation. In November 1983, legislation was signed, creating Martin Luther King Jr. Day, making it only the third national holiday born in the 20th century. In fall 1991, the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, where he was assassinated, was dedicated to his remembrance. On October 16, 2011, the MLK Memorial was dedicated on the National Mall. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., In Black America. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is considered by many as the father of the civil rights movement. Born on Tuesday, January 15, 1929, at the family home in Atlanta, Georgia, he was christened Michael Luther King, but in 1934, Daddy King changed his name after young Martin experienced racial prejudice. In 1944, at the age of 15, he graduated high school and entered Morehouse College in Atlanta, with intention on becoming a medical doctor, but changed his mind in his junior year. In April 1948, King received his bachelor's degree in sociology and entered Crozier Theological Seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania. In May 1951, he graduated with a Bachelor of Divinity degree and as valedictorian and student body president. In 1955, he earned his doctorate in systematic theology from Boston University. In spring 1963, King nonviolent tactics were put to their most severe test in Birmingham, Alabama, during a mass protest for fair hiring practices and the desegregation of department stores. Police brutality used against the marchers dramatized the plight of African Americans to the nation at large with enormous impact. Established in 1968 by Mr. Coretta Scott King, the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change has been a global destination, resource center, and community institution for over a quarter century. Nearly a million people each year make their way to the National Historic Site to learn, be inspired, and pay their respect to Dr. King's legacy. On January 20 of 1986, the night before the first national celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, Ms. King spoke about her husband and the King Center.
The dreams on which the center is based are bigger than any one of us, yet an integral part of all of us. And so, like all meaningful dreams, the center will endure. The center will always respond to realities, basing its programs on the needs, aspirations, and the aspirations of humankind. It will always stand ready in the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr. to work through programs that, in a clear, comprehensive, and challenging way, use principles of nonviolence in changing lives in social, economic, and political systems. The center is dynamic and in motion, and like this year's theme, is actively helping those who wish to live the dream and saying to all of us that we must not just talk about the dream, we must every day engage ourselves in living the dream. And I say to you tonight that we are challenged at the center to dream like Martin Luther King Jr., impossible dreams, and like Martin Luther King Jr., work untiringly for the fulfillment of those dreams. I can tell you the story of the center has been an impossible dream, and I'm sure Mrs. Ferris can attest to that fact. And as someone said today in our board meeting, I believe it was our chairman, he said, somehow, we don't know how, but somehow, maybe it was Lloyd Davis, our executive director of the Holiday Commission, and Mr. Hill, but there's been something very special about this holiday experience.